Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint recap from the Center for International Maritime Security. Today's extended episode is a chat on future threats with SimSec Super Friends, the Project on International Peace and Security from William and Mary, the Fletcher School's Neptune Group, and the Phoenix Think Tank. We talk about the next 5 to 10 years in maritime security, concentrating on human security, China, and the economy. Remember, we are available on iTunes, Stitcher Stream Radio, and a bunch of other places my Google data can't identify. Please leave a comment and a 5-star rating. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, and anyone who says otherwise appreciates neither your company nor your taste in music. Now, sit back and enjoy the show.
Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. Today's episode is an introduction, if you will, of the different forums with which SimSec partners. We have three guests: Alexander Clark of the Phoenix Think Tank, Professor Dennis Smith of PIPS at William & Mary, and Chris Peterson at the Fletcher School's Neptune Group. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So the purpose of our podcast today is threat projection. There's a lot of known knowns, unknown knowns, and you could say unknown unknowns, but we wouldn't be able to talk about them because we wouldn't know what they are. So we're going to take these different perspectives from our different partners, people of different experience, and try to divine, if you will, what's going to happen in the next decade or so. But before we begin, I want to give everyone an opportunity to introduce themselves and the organization that they represent. Alex, I'll start off with you from the Phoenix Think Tank.
Right then. The Phoenix Think Tank is a voluntary think tank. We're run with absolutely no money. We're made up of retired naval officers, academics like me. I've just finished my PhD at King's College London in War Studies Department under Professor Lambert, and some other experienced people, a fair number of smattering of Army and Royal Marines. Our mission is to improve the level of debate in the UK on defence and especially the maritime sphere. We've been looking at things like the Royal Navy isn't very good at selling itself. It's got a tradition of being a silent service, and it's very good at, with a can-do attitude of going ahead and making the best it can with what it's given. It's not very good at arguing for more funding, etc., when it needs it, and can be seen from the escort numbers, which have gone down.
Yeah, we recently had Brian McGrath as a guest, and his piece in AEI on NATO ship numbers touched on that, and it's kind of frightening to look at. Professor Dennis Smith, you represent PIPS from William & Mary. Please, you have the floor.
Yeah. Hi, yeah. My name is Dennis Smith. I received my PhD from the University of Virginia in Foreign Affairs. I specialize in international security with a subspecialization in security studies. And I run an undergraduate think tank here at the college that teams talented undergraduates with members of the policy community. And what we do is we basically use these students to kind of harness their energy and creativity to help do threat projection and propose novel policy proposals. So a lot of what we do is we've worked with the CIA, we've worked with U.S. Army TRADOC and a variety of other organizations, and we basically tap into these students' heads to help figure out long-term trends. As far as my own work, I do work in strategic studies, but I'm primarily a coercion and regime stability expert.
So what you're saying is you've been an incredibly busy person for the past decade plus.
Very.
And I'm sure the guys listening that have been undergrads themselves, that have done the liberal arts degrees, if you will, appreciate that, because you take undergrads and the number of 5, 10, and 20-page reports that I just churned out and ended up sitting and getting dusty on a shelf, I wonder how much of that effort could have been put to better use. So PIBS is a really great program, trying to take a lot of that burn and churn and put it towards something outside the classroom. So that's excellent.
Yeah. We basically think that undergraduates are an untapped national resource, and we have been pairing them up with members of the policy community and then through our own kind of internal work, producing reports for a variety of folks.
And Chris, Chris Peterson, Fletcher School's Neptune Group. The Neptune Group has been on a podcast with us before, with Carolyn. We were talking about China, the ADIS, and the Arctic. If you would, please introduce yourself and talk a little bit about the Neptune Group and the Fletcher School and what you do.
Sure. Thanks, Matt, and a pleasure to be here. I've also touched base with Grant Greenwell, who I think is a regular member of your podcast up here. The Fletcher School is a leading institution of international affairs. I'm a second-year graduate student. Prior to starting my studies again, I was a dry cargo ship broker. So I worked in the commercial shipping business in the Panamax and Handymax sectors in Hong Kong and Tokyo, where I was working with the Japanese majors. Primarily, I was dealing with coal and grain cargoes in the Pacific, but would touch a lot in the dry bulk business, from iron ore to a variety of ores and tremendous amount of cargoes. It's exciting business, but I wanted to come back to school to enhance and broaden my understanding of the maritime world. Where at Fletcher, we have a small maritime studies program, and the Neptunes Group is somewhat affiliated. It's our club at Fletcher that focuses on maritime studies, and it's very interdisciplinary. Some students have an environmental focus of pollution and regulation at sea. Maritime law is particularly interesting. Of course, naval security and strategy comes up a fair amount. And then international trade issues and commercial shipping business is of interest to me and to several students as well. So we try to touch on a wide variety of issues and themes within our group, which is common to the Fletcher School as well as an interdisciplinary program. And it's a pleasure to be here.
You know, it should be noted that you may have a small maritime program, but it does have itself a Commodore, because Admiral Stavridis is now at the Fletcher School. And it's good to note, too, you get a lot of bloggers and article writers, USNI's Proceeding, Small Wars Journal, that kind of stuff, where when you start to talk about maritime security, a lot of us concentrate, because that's where we're from, on the strategic military angle, and it's good to have you here, Chris, because you have that commercial background. Some of you may have heard the podcast before. Chris Barber is our membership secretary, and he's a Marine, but he went to the Merchant Marine Academy, so it's always very helpful to have him aboard as well. So the topic of today's podcast, threat projection. Everyone's following the news. We have drunk North Korean dictators executing their uncle. We have ships entering the Black Sea to defend the to possibly evacuate people from the Olympics. We have more conventional threats like potential Chinese territorial expansion in the South China Sea. And then we have stranger political events, President Aquino calling out the Chinese and comparing them to the Nazi regime's territorial expansion into Czechoslovakia and Poland. So the world has a lot of these expanding and evolving areas of possible conflict. And our objective here today is to divine those out, decide what's the most important and to whom. Of course, Phoenix Think Tank, you know, you guys are of the European persuasion, so we all...
I wouldn't say that.
No?
I'd say, well, no. You have to remember, Britain is a global trading nation. We trade, our trade with the rest of the world is vastly growing further than the European Union. And so we're increasingly looking further and further in what we're going to be doing and where our security is going to be. And there is a great argument coming back that we're actually moving more towards sea basing and could be looking at a rebalancing of the budget in the future because of the need to be a global presence. Now, that's not being the same as being a global policeman, but it is the same looking after your interests on the global scale.
My apologies. What I meant to illustrate is that we talk mostly about the United States, and I'm glad to have a non-U.S. perspective, or rather non-U.S. focus on security, so we don't go down that stovepipe looking at security from one angle. But I stand duly corrected. So, gentlemen, Alex, actually, you know what? Let's start off with you. You're already on a roll. You started off on the issues of British rebalancing and their global concerns. Your thoughts on future threats, for the United Kingdom, their strategic concerns, and what do you think is the most important issue in the next 5 to 10 years that we will have to concentrate on?
Well, the thing I worry about most is trade. And when I'm talking about that, I mean energy supplies and food supplies. We are incredibly dependent upon imports in our country. And even with the shale gas possible, if it's used or not, and there's all sorts of debates going on about that, and I love the way the strategic part of the debate is left completely out of it. It's all environmental. And I don't mind that to an extent, and the environmental is important, but forgetting the strategic side does mean that we are more dependent upon importing gas. Now, we have a gas carrier comes into the UK every single day, pretty much. Two oil tankers every day. If that supply, if that invisible roadway is cut for even a short amount of time, we haven't got supplies because we've moved into the very capitalist, very modern model of just-in-time logistics, where nothing is sort of being held in reserve because that's wasted money or capital not being used. So for us, that's a big thing. But if you look around, what can influence that? There's denial of service attacks on stage, on refineries, on oil rigs in the middle of the sea, which could be terrorists. They could be major states. If you look at the South China Sea, which might become an oil producing area soon, there are territorial conflicts which are going to involve in that.
When you talk about denial of service attacks, are you saying, are you talking about, denying these access to these platforms to people, or are you talking about cyber attacks on the equipment that's being used?
It can be both. This is the thing. If you become obsessed with cyber, you're going to forget about the physical security. If you become obsessed with physical security, you tend to forget about the cyber. You have to put both in. There's an incredibly attractive thing with many politicians and many elected governments, because they are elected on a 4 or 5 year cycle, to go for what is considered a short-term problem to deal with that they can deal with in that time. The trouble with defense and security is it's long-term. You have to think 20, 30 years. You can't think short-term. And these problems are not short-term in that everything's becoming more and more connected to the internet, so you can have more cyber problems. But if you just have electronic security on an oil rig, how difficult it is for someone to get a boat using a GPS system, get motor out to that oil rig and just climb board if there's no people on it. You can put in some protections, but you cannot make it foolproof because there'll need to be some spaces for maintenance access. And the moment you have to have some space for maintenance access, that means there's going to be a way to get in. And so you have to balance the two. You have to think it through. And if you move it on, there's also the piracy problems and the non-state actors at the sea. And this growing idea, I've been watching with quite a lot of interest, especially the small European nations, have been focusing on the idea of arming their freighters and arming their merchant ships. And it's almost going back to the 17th, 18th century, where the navy is no longer being relied upon for the security of the sea, which is what they've ever been doing. And the reason for that is because of the shortage of escort numbers, which is a long-term thing. The Cold War has ended. We don't need these warships anymore. We don't need to reserve the sea because there's no threat of the Soviet submarines. Well, A, Russia's rearming, China's getting bigger, and these things are coming back, so these are the conventional threats. But those escorts weren't just there for the conventional threats. They were there for the pirates. They were there for the naval diplomacy, the presence, the being able to turn up in a country and host a nice dinner and go, look at us, we are a great country, which helped security as well because it showed was a physical presence showing that we could reach there, but also showing the nicer side. And I can ramble on for longer.
Of course. Professor Smith, all right, we've heard from Alex. We've heard about human security issues when it comes to energy and food supplies, talking about access to the populace for day-to-day things that they need to survive and in many ways regime survival where governments – rely on their ability to provide for their peoples. Your thoughts on the coming security concerns in the next 5 to 10 years?
I'm going to add to what Alex said, but I'm going to refocus it towards Asia. There's this assumption, particularly in the defense establishment, when they look at China, they just assume that GDP growth is projected out as a straight line and that it's always positive. but we're increasingly seeing signs that the Chinese economy is going to start to slow. And what is this going to actually mean for Chinese foreign policy? As the economy starts to slow, and particularly as the population has accepted basically a better standard of living, there's going to be a lot of political pressure on to do something about it. And you can imagine, particularly as energy prices rise, that this will create a great deal of temptation for the Chinese government to either rattle the saber to divert the population from their concerns, or to actually start, making those strong claims in the South China Sea or off the coast of Japan. And what I worry about is a weak PRC who feels that its legitimacy is being challenged by slow economic growth, and them striking out and trying to, like I said, divert the population, or actually trying to go out and acquire resources. I mean, part of what drove the Japanese to launch their island campaign in World War II was that Japan felt that it was cut off to natural resources, primarily by the United States, and that motivated them to begin their portion of World War II. The same dynamic could play out with China as it slows.
Now, when you refer to a weak PRC, could you flesh out your concerns on what do you mean by weakness? Because
I mean, they are militarily growing in strength. There's no doubt about that. Politically, however, they are sitting on the razor's edge. They, after Tiananmen Square, they essentially cut a deal with their population that everyone would get malls and superhighways, and you would see a rising standard of living as long as they didn't challenge the authority of the Communist Party. And so far, that's worked for them. What the big question is what's going to happen when they can't provide that, when that growth actually slows? And we're already starting to see a bit of this. Part of this is related to they just can't keep growing the way they are. I mean, we're seeing, high levels of inflation. We're also probably seeing a real estate bubble. I mean, there are whole cities and in neighborhoods, in some of the major cities that have been built that are actually empty. No one's moving into them. And it's being covered up through a variety of mechanisms by the party, but it's obvious for all to see. And then there's just growing income inequality in China, where those that have close party connections are making vast sums of money at the expense of many. A colleague of mine describes China as two Chinas, China A and China B. China A is the gleaming cities and those people that are growing in wealth. And there's China B, which represents the majority of China, which is kind of this vast poor peasantry that in many ways are still caught back in, living standards in the 1950s and 1960s. And what they see is this growing income gap in China that is really stoking popular resentment. On a daily basis now, there are protests throughout China. The party tries to keep it quiet, but the protests are growing and growing and growing in number. And most of it right now is focused on low-level Chinese Communist Party corruption. But there's a potential for this to actually, go quite widespread. And this political instability could translate into kind of foreign policy adventurism on the part of the Communist Party. Because while they may be weak politically, Chinese nationalism is very, very strong and is at all-time highs. And there could be a potential that they would play on that.
There's a disturbing parallel that's also rather ironic when it comes to the Communist Party, where what do you describe when you talk about government corruption, income disparity, strength in the cities? You start thinking, are we talking about modern-day China, or are we talking about nationalist China before its fall to communism? It almost sounds like we're looking at a and I realize it's a sloppy comparison,
and I actually think that the Communist Party's probably sees this comparison, right, and are very, very worried about that. When I lecture on this to my students, I tell them, really, if we look at Chinese foreign policy from the perspective that the party believes that it's in a race, that it has to move as many people from China B, the poor China, to China A as rapidly as possible before the laws of economics start affecting them, before all this environmental pollution that they pushed out actually starts affecting their ability to produce, and a variety of different factors. They're in a race, and if they can't move enough people from one column to the other quickly enough, they're going to be faced with some real serious instability, at which point I have no idea what the PRC is going to do. we can look like past governments who've confronted this, and what you tend to see is diversionary wars, particularly minor kind of nationalistic things. So you could see asserting rights about some islands off the coast of Japan, or trying to assert themselves more in the South China Sea. And while this represents what I consider like a short-term threat, it's not really a tremendous threat. I think we're already starting to see what's happening with the Philippines, for example. China's been rattling its saber, and they're now the net of containment is now starting to kind of surround them. And this also worries them. So combined with containment starting to grow and potential political instability, we're entering a dangerous period for China.
There's also, using the China A, China B strategy, there is a problem with that. People in China A are a growing middle class. And middle classes are a problem for dictatorships. Throughout history, they've always been the problem. The lower classes, they tend to be having to concentrate too much on working to get enough money to feed their family, that sort of thing. Middle class have free time. They have education. They have some money to spare, so they can start to organize. The moment people can start to organize, they can start to cause trouble for governments. If you can look at the Middle East, that was exactly what's happened there. It's a growth in technology and communications technology systems which has allowed them to do it, but it was the middle class which causes the trouble, which takes down the governments, because they're the ones who have the time to organize, the ones who have the time to do those things. And for China, this is their problem, in that, yes, they can move people to China A, and that's better for them, and they're going to be happy for a few years, but long term, that creates a middle class, which then creates even more problems. And because they're the ones who are going to disagree with a communist system, with a one-party system, because they're going to want their say and have different views.
So, let's just hope they don't have a recession, right? I mean, so now
that's just something you just don't want to go there.
Right, I mean, that's
now scary.
You don't want to go there, but sometimes you don't exactly get a choice. America learned that unfortunate lesson. So, Professor Alex, you're both talking different tacks on the issue of human security. So, Alex, you're talking about it more holistically, looking around the world. Professor, it almost looks like you're concentrating more on the effects on a certain state's strategic impact on the world around it when facing that kind of problem. Chris, fingers crossed. Saving the best for last.
No problem.
Your perspective on the coming strategic challenges for the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, I think certainly our eyes quickly went to the East and South China Seas and China, which is natural. And I think we've covered that pretty well. So if I have anything to add, it may be more along the lines of what Alex mentioned, as on the East in the Indian Ocean, kind of the Horn of Africa issue, which I forget the statistics, but in 2013, they've come out now and right, piracy rates have plummeted. We're doing an excellent job at patrolling sea lanes there and keeping piracy in check. One of my concerns really, and you just touched upon it, kind of the holistic onshore dilemma, is really, are we going to continue to do this? Is this kind of a permanent operation where we provide, and as well kind of the ship operators and owners who are Alex touched upon kind of paying for armed guard service and insurance agencies that are wrapped up in this. Are we going to continue to do this? Because the real problem is on shore in East Africa and kind of the unrest there, that once the service is potentially, if we would move on and taxpayers don't want to pay for given service in the Indian Ocean, our eyes move to Asia, et cetera. Will piracy then return and kind of in the mess that we saw from 2006 through 11? So I think, and I know our Dean Servetus is a huge proponent of this, is sort of where's the maritime realm end and the onshore problems begin? And certainly, we need to do a better job at trying to solve, onshore problems, say in East Africa.
He also talks a lot about the dark side. I really enjoy his perspective on the dark side of globalization. Not globalization itself in the conventional sense that we understand it as a commercial construct, but rather the ability of rebels in Mali to send emails to and or trade lessons with folks in the Central African Republic, or pirates in Nigeria to talk to pirates in Somalia, and for this unvirtuous cycle of learning that can occur I think an important point on piracy, you mentioned piracy, as you look at the difference between piracy in Nigeria and Somalia, the problem with Somalia there being no government, problem in Nigeria being there's an incredibly corrupt government. So in a lot of these cases, it almost seems as though pirates aren't just going out and capturing random ships. They're gathering information. They're focusing on particular vessels. And these are very focused, targeted, intelligence-heavy operations, I would say in many cases. The recently stolen oil tanker. These aren't random. These, you know, you're using state assets that have been corrupted for information for your operation.
And they're long term. Sorry to butt in, but
no, of course, no.
Piracy, which has been going on, for example, in Southeast Asia and the Singapore Straits.
People forget about that.
Decades, and people forget about them. And that's a lot of the trouble with the maritime problems and with maritime security. Because they're out of sight for much of the population, they're out of mind. And one of the interesting things I've been finding out really sort of interesting recently is people's reaction to learning there is now more piracy taking place on the west coast of Africa than there is on the east. Because you still hear in the press about the east coast, but it's very rare you see press articles on the west coast of Africa and the issues that are taking place there.
Unless you read SimSec.
Yeah, SimSec is very good.
I think raising awareness is excellent sort of on the piracy issues, which I think then naturally you see the population demanding greater interest in the maritime space. But just on a distinction, right, the west coast and east coast African dilemmas are quite different. And using the word piracy, some of the articles I've been reading isn't exactly correct, right? These are basically, it's the thieves almost, in West Africa. The dilemma there is quite different, which is happening in territorial waters and what kind of service could potentially the international community provide the West African states, becomes quite problematic. Where in East Africa is basically in open waters, and we've successfully basically quelled the piracy dilemma at the moment.
Yeah. So what do navies do? We have two challenges here. One, it's selecting the concentration of what a navy can do. We talk a lot about the issues of piracy, but it seems like a solution to that might be far cheaper than building huge convoy navies is the armed contractor solution. So do navies concentrate on that conventional threat? And secondly, when you look at countries like China or countries like Russia that have that ability, that do not have that flux in leadership that occurs because they are, in the case of Russia, quasi-dictatorship, or China, one-party corporatist state. I don't know what you want. There's so many different ways people describe them. Is how do democratic nations, how do the states that are in NATO, how does the United States, how do they overcome that strategic gap as leaders, and then further, once, let's pretend that strategic gap doesn't exist and you had the ability to do what you want, maybe give some examples of some countries and what you would do with their navies or what you think they should focus on.
Well, in the case of the armed guards on ships, I'm British, and we have a history of not liking private armies. We got rid of ours quite a long the private armies quite a long time ago.
And Cecil Rhodes, yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot better not to have them. They can, whilst they can become very good for a short-term measure, and security guards are one thing, but once you have them start going to sea and they start getting more weapons, eventually you have an almost East India Company-style situation coming up, where you have companies which are actually acting as their own foreign powers. And yes, we have some multinationals which do that today, but they don't have an army as part of them. And it gets very problematic dealing with companies once they have an army as well as all their financial power. So it's better to keep the ability to use force within the state. Now, in terms of how you deal with the problems and make it more long-term thinking, I don't know. The one idea that's been mooted is to give more power to things like the Defence Select Committee, the Parliamentary Defence Select Committee in the UK, and have them do it, have them take a more longer overview approach and provide more regular reports, and longer-term planning goes through them. The French take a thing of putting an act of parliament every time they want to build something. But that doesn't seem to be listened to when they don't want to. So I don't really see that as being useful. It's trying to get past the idea of thinking in 4 or 5 years. It's when we're looking at especially escort numbers and procurement of even rifles now and pistols, we're talking about decades-long procurement tracks. We can't, if it's a decades-long program, it'll go through 3 or 4 project heads, let alone know how many ministers. The recent coalition government in the UK aside, on average, no defence minister has lasted longer than 18 months in the UK. And that's going to cause trouble. If the head of the department keeps changing, every time there's a new head of the department, they're going to launch a review into everything, and they're going to start filling with stuff. So it's trying to have some sort of stability at the top. I think one of the things I'm tempted to say in the UK is that certain posts, I would love them to become a sort of almost like the Prime Minister's post, where once they're put in for the election and they've been settled into cabinet, they then stay, short of a major thing, them happening, going wrong, and them having to remove from office for perjury or something like that. As for how I would change navies, well, I've been looking a lot recently and thinking about 2 concepts which I've been looking at, which is global presence and global reach. Your global reach assets are things like your aircraft carriers, you know, destroyers. They're the war-fighting things. You need to deploy to areas to fight wars and deal with major threats. But you also need to have global presence assets. These are things which you can deploy around the world and just keep there as a presence. Now, the Germans are looking at a class of frigate corvettes which are going to be able to be forward deployed and minimally maintained. That's one option. The other option is to build more smaller ships, build corvettes and have them have a range, basic armaments so they can take part in task group defense and that sort of thing. But in wartime, they're second-rate assets. But in peacetime, they are first-rate assets because they have a nice entertaining space and they can wander around the world and they can deal with counter-piracy.
And for those that are interested in corvettes, just a reminder, SimSec did have a corvette week last November, and the Chuck Hill podcast was about 2 weeks ago. So if you'd like to find more information that goes in depth on corvettes and small ships, I'd recommend and invite you to go look at those assets. Sorry, actually.
They were great.
Chuck's great. It was absolutely fascinating. He's like an encyclopedia.
I've written a couple of papers recently around that topic because I've been doing a lot of work on global presence, and looking at corvette design was one of the papers I put up on my own blog. And the whole ideas that go around them. But it's not just that sort of thing. Because if you're looking at global presence, and if you're looking at those things, it's not just the ships which come up. We've been rightfully talking about the stuff on land. And that brings us to 2 options. You can either have bases on land, or you can sea base. If you pick the sea base, you then need to think, what sort of assets are we going to use? And I've been very interested in the development of the marine APC. Because looking at the big assault vehicles, they're great. They can carry a large number of troops. But how often do I want to use a large number of troops to deploy? For a smaller operation, I want to deploy troops in penny packets. And deploying them by helicopter is okay. But once they're deployed by helicopter, they end walking everywhere usually. So actually, deploying them in an APC is best. And it also gives them fire support wherever they are. And somewhere to bunker down and move if they're in trouble.
And that gets you back, of course, to the procurement issue, because every time you come up with a brand new awesome idea, you realize that the procurement systems here in the United States, and this would be a topic for an entirely new podcast, we always talk about reforming Title 10. If you want to be jealous, when I was at Georgetown, one of my classes had a Senegalese Air Force officer come in. He was a procurement guy, and he described this procurement process, which was him going to the country, looking at a few planes, pointing to one, flying it, deciding it was good, and then flying each one of them back to Senegal. So it was a one man, one up process. Just, hey, I like this one. I'm a pilot. Nah, it feels all right. Here, we'll take 2 or 3. Now I'm going to fly each one of them back to Senegal. Just right. an incredible dream that we'll never be able to accomplish. But I don't want to close out our other guests. Of course, Alex, feel free to jump back in, but I want to be able to move on, Professor Smith. Maybe give your perspective. What should navies be concentrating on? And maybe more from the U.S. perspective, maybe reforms you think would be useful in not necessarily the procurement side, but maybe to a point, but assessing and fixing our ability to make long-term strategic plans.
Oh, that's a big question. As far as the U.S. goes and the role of navies, the thing that keeps running through my mind is I just don't know where the money is. The cost curve for us is not good. Every platform that we come out is increasingly more costly, and we're entering kind of an era of austerity. And one of the things that has really kind of shocked me coming out of our defense establishment is basically the lack of strategic creativity. I've attended a series of kind of futurist, military events in the last year from Air Force and Army and a little bit for the Navy. And, I'm just not seeing much creativity there. In the past, I think we got used to throwing money at things. And, now it's a function of we don't have the money and we can't throw those dollars there. So what do we do? As far as on the creative end, as far as navies go, I actually agree with Alex's point about the corvettes. I think the littoral combat ship was a mistake. It's too short-legged. It needs to be able to deploy long range and with minimal support, and that the corvette idea is a better fit. And I've talked to a few folks in the Navy recently who kind of, you know, under the table have essentially said the same thing, and these are actually quite senior folks. Is the Navy going to admit its mistake? Probably not. And so what's the way forward? On the presence mission, I'm thinking that the cheapest thing the Navy can do now, and it's not much of a presence, is, you know, with a focus on UAVs, particularly UAVs to help deal with piracy. I mean, part of what's going on with piracy is that, these pirates are able to kind of sneak up on these ships. If you could create a UAV surveillance network that would essentially serve almost kind of anti-piracy air traffic, you know, traffic control, that you could actually steer ships away from other suspicious vessels, that might be helpful. On as far as the U.S. Navy goes in dealing with future threats, I'm actually more optimistic about our potential to deal with, let's say, the Chinese threat than I think some folks in the Navy are. If you look at just the geography of Asia, China's ringed in. I mean, we talk about, you know, there's a famous quote by MacArthur that Taiwan's an unsinkable aircraft carrier off the coast of China. Well, the problem with China is that it has a series of unsinkable aircraft carriers right off the coast of China, right? From Japan down to the Philippines, down to Indonesia. And while the Chinese have been developing an anti-access air denial capability, and we've been, in a certain sense, foolishly trying to roll that back, there will come a time where those island nations will themselves develop anti-access area denial, but oriented towards China, and that first island chain will constitute, to a certain extent, I mean, and this is kind of a bad analogy, but almost like a Maginot line, but a maritime Maginot line.
Instantly, right? Became a bad analogy.
Yeah.
Like, wait, the Maginot line didn't work.
They do is invade through Russia then.
Right, invade through Russia. But I mean, if you look at it from a maritime perspective, each one of these nations, if they develop a significant anti-access air denial capability, you know, lots of anti-ship cruise missiles, what are the Chinese left with, right? I mean, basically we reversed the strategy that they're adopting against us would be reversed against them, and they would leave their ports and become automatically targeted. Our real issue is going to be with the anti-access threat, not just going from China, but from everyone. And how will the U.S. Navy challenge this? The corvettes won't survive, but to the extent that the corvettes don't need to survive, that's fine in an era of peacetime. Once we move out of that, I know Andrew Krepinevich over at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment, his favorite new weapon system to counter this threat is, you know, high-energy lasers. The problem with high-energy lasers is, like with all lasers, they don't really work well in a maritime environment. That's why when you ever see Lockheed test one of these things, it's on a clear day, because sea mist really screws with optics. And
people really do forget that pure physics problem. They think of it in, you know, the Star Wars and Star Trek sense.
Yeah. And I think what we're heading towards long term, and then the subsurface folks will like this, is a greater emphasis on subsurface. It's the only way to be able to maintain sea lines of communication, but it's not going to look the way we've traditionally maintained sea lines of communication through being able to force them open with escorts. I think we're heading into a world of deterrence, but maritime deterrence. Think of it as maritime MAD, where trading states hold the capability of cutting off access to these important communications lines, and everyone deters each other this way. And those nations that develop the capability to force open sea lines of communication will be few, and that capability will be incredibly expensive.
In two thoughts on that from presentations I've seen. Bill Murray works at the Naval War College, and a long time ago I saw him do a presentation using Google Earth that was talking about ways to strike or ways to bring down certain countries. I think it was how would the Chinese approach Taiwan, and showing how something as simple as Google Earth could show you a country's major infrastructural weaknesses. And in combining that with War on the Rocks, had a podcast recently on the Cold War, and one of their final reflections was the issue of PGMs, precision-guided munitions, and how that you have these more and more focused munitions, and they be able to strike very weak points in a very judo-like way may change that. Because you look and you say unsinkable aircraft carrier, but you know, you still need a functioning flight deck on an aircraft carrier. So how much of those assets can you still use? So,
well, the question would be mobility, right? I mean, everyone's going to have this. I was at an Army event recently where they predicted that that in 20 years, practically everyone is going to have robotics. And, that advantage that we have in both sensor technology and processing and robotics will be essentially wiped away. You can imagine a very similar circumstance in the maritime realm. Everyone's going to have precision guided capability. And what we're left with is just inflicting massive amounts of punishment on each other. And the term for that is, you know, mutually assured destruction, a la the Cold War.
Maybe, let me plug myself. Sorry, guys. really quick. On the issue of surface combatants and attacking that precision part of guided munitions is, I put up an article called Bring on the Countermeasure Drones that talks about that offense-defense advantage. And, you know, we approach drones, you talked about robotics, in a very focused way. Hey, how do I make a robotic fighter aircraft? How do I make a robotic reconnaissance drone? Nobody thinks, hey, it's a drone, it doesn't have a human being, can I throw a beacon on it and have it fly around and have missiles chase it around all over the ocean? As a possibility of a way of deterring this mass attack type issue with missiles.
I would also be worried about anti-access systems, in that I wrote a post a while ago which was looking at the anti-ship ballistic missile. And that's got incredible amounts of problems with the idea of using it. Yes, it's a lovely thing to have. It's a great statement of capabilities. But actually, the cruise missiles are more effective, and you're less likely to set off a massive nuclear exchange.
Nuclear exchange, yeah.
Yes, because you're relying on, and I'm possibly going to get in trouble here, there is a European joke which occasionally comes up, which is, it depends whether you've got an Obama, a Clinton, or a Bush in charge. Because Bush would probably reach straight for the explosive and fire the missiles. Clinton would ring up and try and talk to them, and Obama would possibly diver. That was the joke. I will admit that I have no opinion on that.
Wow, that's good.
Body
that
blows.
Was the joke. And it was the case of, is that really something which China's going to do? It's a great statement to say, we have this capability, but that's even before actually looking at the practicality of the capability. Because if you're talking about it, you're going to have sensors having to detect where the carrier group is going to be, and where it's going to be hopefully in about 45 minutes an hour. Then you've got, that data has got to go back to the command center. Commander's got to agree to it. Then send that back to the strategic commander, because you can guarantee no president is going to give away the power to launch a ballistic missile to his local theater commander. He's going to want to weigh up the politics of it first, which means there's probably going to be a cabinet meeting in China, which will add on another hour. So by the time they actually get round to launching the missile, that's 2 hours later. And that's if there isn't an AQ-47 or whatever its derivative is sitting over nice and quietly wherever the launch site is, waiting for that missile to appear out of the launcher and go boom with a nice precision guided munition straight on top.
And before we go any further, Chris, I'm sorry, man, but you know what? It's, I'm saving the best for last. We have our discussion, you know, the military guys, and then we go to you, the guy who actually has to operate in the ships that do 90% of the transiting on the sea.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a tidbit I can bring in on the commercial element, but
it doesn't have to be commercial. Just give you're listening to us wax poetic, and you're the guy who's on the commercial vessel that's in the middle of all these explosions and fire. So I value your perspective on what we're talking about here.
No, you guys are the ones out there protecting the vessels, and I'm not, certainly not a merchant marine. I was sitting in the back office, you know, making phone calls, by no means putting myself in any danger. But, trying to think of a tidbit I can add on this front, and struggling for a bit and learning a lot from you guys. So I've been an avid listener of your podcast since I picked up with it end of last fall. And I had the pleasure actually to listen to Bill Murray over the Naval War College presentation on Chinese capabilities and his work with Google Earth, kind of trying to learn what their capabilities vis-a-vis Taiwan really are. So I've had that pleasure as well. But right now just trying to learn a little bit and trying to think of something I can throw out there. But
I have a question for Chris.
Sure.
What do you think about the arming of these merchant ships?
Good point.
I heard something about that if these ships got armed, it would just radically increase their insurance costs.
Yeah, I think it is a major problem that has already happened. And that cost, right, eventually is passed on to the consumer. So, which I haven't seen the statistics on it, but I'm sure that it's calculated what the eventual drag on the global economy is. So my real concern, though, would be more along the lines, though, of security concerns in the sense we come with a gun, the pirates come with a rocket launcher, right? I mean, kind of the escalation problem you see potentially at sea, I think, is one of the major concerns. Otherwise, I think I touched on it beforehand, though, is I'm somewhat interested in sort of how long are we going to provide this security and transport services in the Indian Ocean? I can't imagine that it's going to be a permanent operation and task force provided by the international community and the navies of the world. And I think we need to focus more on land and sort of trying to solve this failed state in Somalia and try to provide these potential pirates another means of labor and a quality life. I think that's one of the serious concerns in the coming decades.
I think that actually takes us back to China, because that's one of the interesting situations we've got in the world, with our global world and global trade and all these things. You have this economy, which is a huge manufacturing economy, where the wages are kept artificially low because the currency is kept artificially weak. So that makes it very cheap to build there.
Which means people
aren't going
Doge
to these
coin.
Other countries to build factories to employ the people. And the moment China has to unpick its currency is going to cause massive ripples throughout the world economy. You could, that will cause 20, 30 years of very strange things, because that has been such a linchpin, but also an artificial thing in the world economy. It's an artificial position holding everything in place, and it's meant that we've got all this trade now going there, and all coming from there, and all the manufacturing. And if you look at the huge ships being built to ply that trade route between Europe and America and China, I think the new triple E's are massive.
Yeah.
I forget how many TEUs they carry.
18,000.
They are colossal. My father was a naval architect, and I remember once when I was younger, he was describing a container ship, and he was working even then on, and this was, must have been about 15 years ago, on one which would take 28,000.
Huh.
And when he was telling me about, that was basically at that time, three of those would have filled the UK's container needs pretty much at that time.
Wow.
And
wow.
That's what he's sort of talking about with these massive ships. And that also, if you take that back to the idea which Professor Smith brought up earlier about the navies going more and more undersea, I do agree with that to an extent that I think the undersea arms are going to get far more important and stronger. But I think you're still going to have the surface ships, because the only way to protect those massive container ships is going to be with a surface ship. Because it's going to have something sitting there, and if it disappears, they're going to feel they're unprotected. For the morale of the merchant crews, you have to have something sitting on the surface. And if you build something which is submersible and it has to sit on the surface at all points, then you've wasted a lot of money.
You know, a lot of what we're talking about starts getting connected to that offshore control, air-sea battle, that whole debate. And just so folks listening, if you're interested, come March, we will have a podcast with Tim Walton from Delix, and TX Hams will be talking to us as well about the confluence of air-sea battle, offshore control, where they butt heads, where they might be able to find some confluence, and as well as Farouk Tamrizi, an economist, to talk about. Something I actually want to ask you, gentlemen, is the replaceability of the Chinese economy. We always talk about the manufacturing and the reliance of the global economy on China. How many, I mean, you have Vietnam, you have India, you have Burma's just opened up. A lot of people, I think, assume outside of finances, because of course that's a whole nother can of worms. But when it comes to manufacturing, is that the world is reliant on China, but it seems like there are plenty of economies that could take up the slack of Chinese manufacturing and would love to in order to further the developing of their economy. So do we possibly overestimate that as a factor in our strategic calculus?
I'm going to butt in first again. Sorry. I think it's not just, we have to not just look at the East and the Far East for the economies which are going to, which would take over. I think you have to look at Africa, South
Absolutely.
America. These are areas, continents with large amounts of populations who are unemployed, but who are getting more and more educated, who are more and more capable, who could well be very good at manufacturing. And the factories that they would get in, if China economy was sort of replaced in this role, would actually boost their economies in the country to the next level. You might actually start getting the middle classes coming through more than they are now. And this is the thing again with China. It's, as I was saying earlier, it's such an artificial linchpin for the global economy because of them keeping wages and currency weak and low. It's just, it is replaceable, but as the transition would be decades.
Yeah, I agree with that. If the transition's slow, South America would be is a good example. Africa is also a very good example. These are kind of, particularly in South America, these are kind of mid-level income countries that so far haven't been able to like push into the upper tier of states, but then also have wages that are slightly above what you would see in China. And if Chinese manufacturing started dwindling, this would open up an avenue for South America and all of these countries.
Chris?
Yeah, well, I'm most concerned, of course, I think, should that the economy in China slow down, I think it'd be pretty devastating, and you see those ripple effects throughout the global economy. So I can't imagine it being easily replaceable. I think my short answer would be that no, it's not easily replaceable. And maybe some of these South American African economies, I'd say, are far off from being able to do that. South America, yeah, a bit closer, but I would still say no, wouldn't be able to take up the slack on that.
That is true. Africa does have, but you know, we've done our Africa Navies Week, and there's been a lot of talk recently. And when it comes to good governance, Africa does have severe problems. I mean, even India, which is a military, which is contends militarily with China and is a major trader, still has huge problems with red tape and opening small businesses and entrepreneurship that folks have to overcome. And that's talking about a developing and or in many ways already developed country. You know, we're not even going into the realms of the problems that Africa has.
And that's leaving aside the social problems India's currently
going through. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
At the moment, you know, some of their cases on women's rights, etc., are from my friends who are out there and from people I know who live like me, who have family around there, are causing immense trouble, which is being, to an extent, unreported, but is getting very, very difficult for the political classes to sort of deal with, because there is a generation gap. And what is important to the younger generation starting to come through in terms of rights and protection and these things has traditionally not been something the previous generations have had to deal with. And it's causing a sort of a cultural division of understanding. And that's going to have an impact as well on sort of that region's security, because it could lead to trouble in this, what is going to be the most populous country in the world at some point.
Yeah. You know, and we haven't even, I just saw something that Armando, posted online as, you know, we haven't even gotten into Iran yet, and, they just posted, pictures of their brand new submarine. So we talk about these major, big picture, and, you know, we still have mid-level threats, like the Iranians and trouble in the Middle East, where even if we look out into the future, we're looking past it almost on purpose. Like, oh, what's next? And they're like, well, unfortunately, the Middle East, has no plans, I don't think, on going anywhere. So it's almost hopeful strategic thinking on our part to think that there are, you know, that we will easily move on, to these new problems.
In fact, the Middle East might get worse. I've just been reading some work on Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia is a very brittle regime. I mean, they're running out. They're running in the next 15 to 20 years, they will be a net oil importer. And while at the same time they're experiencing a youth bulge, and their ability per capita to buy off their population with amenities is going down rapidly. And Saudi Arabia, up till now, has been an important state in the international oil market in that it has been kind of a reserve state that helped stabilize oil prices. It won't be able to provide that service in the future. A lot of where their oil resources are going to, other than that they're just being dried up, is that they're having to rely on – they are developing their own domestic industry as an alternative economic base. And to develop this, they are having to do a lot more desalination, and desalination is all powered by petrol, and it's quite expensive for them. And they are redirecting resources to such an extent that the – figures for Saudi Arabia look quite dire. It's almost like a looming catastrophe that has been ignored, not only by the Saudis, but by practically everyone else. We could expect some significant oil issues in the next 20 years as a result of Saudi Arabia.
And you look on...
No one wants to look under the carpet, do they?
No.
And then also, they, like quite a large amount of Arabia, are experiencing what is described by one of my colleagues at King's, who's done her PhD on something similar, as a gender brain drain. Mm. In that the brighter girls go away to Europe and some to the Far East, but a lot to America as well, to get their degrees, where they're allowed to drive, they're allowed to do things which they aren't at home. They don't go wild or anything like that, but they're allowed more freedom. And then when they finish their degrees, they have a choice of going home and giving up all those freedoms they've got used to, or staying and getting a job with their very good degree. And this is causing a trouble for Saudi Arabia, because they're losing more and more of this thing, and it's creating a sort of imbalance in society. As you said, there's a growing younger population coming through, and they're almost experiencing a similar trouble to what China's going through now, where they have too few girls.
Yeah.
And a lot of the pin action on that is we concentrate on the Middle East when it comes to oil, and some people will counter, well, the United States is a major producer of its own energy now, and we use Canada. The problem is we live in a global market. So the prices of our energy produced at home or not are affected by the supplies outside. And then the pin action off that is to say, well, who else is out there? And you look at places like Nigeria, and then you ask questions of good governance and Boko Haram and the rebellion in the north. And then the picture starts looking a lot more complicated because you have to factor in these other sources, and now you're talking about fuel, and what did we just talk about? We talked about China's economy. So it's, you know, rise, you'd have a rise in oil prices that hit the Chinese economy. You're looking at, they use the term, the domino effect, back during Vietnam, you know, Vietnam falls and it'll be like a domino effect. Well, you're looking at a room full of randomly strewn about dominoes all standing up where you might kick one and the entire room goes down, but you don't know where, it's going to start. You know, it's a very, complicated. Alex, you've got a pensive or very thoughtful look on, Skype. I'm wondering what you're seeing. It's like you're seeing into the future, something's coming up.
I was just thinking of a conversation I was having with Michael Clapp, who's the head of the PTT and was the Commodore in the 1982 Falklands War of the Amphibious Task Group. He was in charge of the ships and the men which went into San Carlos Bay and put the Marines ashore.
Yeah, yes, and just as a note, look up, for everyone listening, he has a great piece on, and he did in 2010, comparing the British Navy during the Falklands War to the British Navy of today and their comparative capabilities, which I thought was an incredibly eye-opening, and in a disturbing way. Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. He is a brilliant guy. I met him first when I interviewed him for my bachelor's dissertation many moons ago, and I have been friends with him ever since, and it's a great honor to be his friend. And while we're on the phone, we were talking about something similar, and this phrase came out, and I've remembered it ever since, which was, what we have to do in the future now is think global, but we've got to remember we've got to act local. In that, we've got to constantly look at the world and think about it in terms of its global effects and its global impacts. We've got to remember the local conditions when we're acting in places. We've got to remember what the local culture is. We can't go in and think that everything's going to act the same way. And it can be different from one street to another. You have to deal with the fact that there are very intricate networks in almost every part of the world. The only part there isn't possibly is the Gobi Desert, where there is virtually no one. So there can't really be an intricate network.
Well, that problem is solved. We can check that one off the list.
You know, at the moment you have people involved, it gets complicated. And one of the great situations I've been looking at recently is with the Western navies especially. You've got commanders are now becoming more and more management style and less what we'd normally consider military leaders. And how is this going to affect the future of them and how they develop?
And it's, you're breaking to an extent, it. Wow, that's the tip of a massive iceberg. I'm sure you followed. There's been a recent debate asking where are the naval strategists, specifically in terms of the United States, and then the debate moved on to, well, where are the professional ones? There are many amateurs and or officers who do it on the side. Are they still within the lifelines? But absolutely, you're right. The change, you say a you could almost say that a peacetime Navy is in a very significant way when you combine it with the network, that we have has created a micro slash management. It's not just micromanagement, but it's a micro and a management, style of leadership that may have very well changed. Like we were talking about earlier, the way of our strategic thinking is the people who do stick around for a very long time. How many more of them are now no longer they're looking down that pipe. They're saying they're looking at the bolts and they're not looking at the entire machine's function.
And I can think of the last one, most recent strategist I can think of to be published, who really was a strategist, at least in the UK, was a guy called James Cable, who was actually an ambassador, a member of the Foreign Office, who'd served in the army for his national service, so had pretty much no naval experience in terms of the traditional sense, but has written a whole series of books on strategy. I think he's dead now. And some of his books were amazing in that what they were looking at as predicting was so many of the problems we're dealing with today, in that the incredible attractive thing for navies is to build battleships, to build the bigger ships, because if you've got the cost, and you're only being given this amount of budget, then it makes sense to build the all-singing dancing ship, because then if you end up in a conflict, you'd be guaranteed to have that ship. It's only when you've got a reliability of income and you can guarantee you're going to have this amount of money every year for the next few years that you start thinking, well, actually, no, I don't need that many of the big ships. I can have a few of the big ships and some small ships of presence. And if you look at traditionally when the Royal Navy has had that, and the US Navy, they had things called light cruisers, which were not really very useful for fighting. They weren't small, nimble enough to be good destroyers for launching torpedoes, and they weren't big enough for fighting like the heavy cruisers. Their main job was presence around the world, was basically going around showing the flag and doing a sort of occasional fighting actions. We today talk about the River Plate, and the reason it's talked about so much is because the light cruisers actually did so well. But the German Navy, when it saw them, the Bismarck, thought they were destroyers because they were that small. And they were basically were present ships.
What was the abysmal ship the British built? What was it, the battle cruiser, where they said, hey, I know, I'll take several million dollars worth of really expensive weaponry, and I'm going to put it on this really paper-thin hull.
That wasn't the brightest idea ever had, but to be honest, the same, it was, Admiral Fisher who came with the idea.
Yeah,
and Fisher, he came with the dreadnoughts, the battleships, thought that was brilliant, and then thought, right, and what I'm going to do is come up with the best commerce protection ship. And this is the trouble. He came up with the idea of the battlecruiser to defend commerce, to deal with bigger than anything. It able to outfight anything it couldn't outrun, and able to outrun anything it couldn't outfight. It wasn't supposed to be in the battle fleet for fighting in a war. But the trouble is, it looks like a battleship, so therefore you have successor admirals and politicians come along who go, well, as it looks like a battleship, let's send it into battle with the battleships. And of course, it...
And it had battle in its name too, so that might be a bad choice.
Yes, and that just... They should have been called something like commerce raider commerce raider ships or something like that, not battle cruisers. Mm. It was a terrible idea, but it wasn't the worst one I've ever seen, which was on paper, which was the idea of a battle carrier, which had a quadruple 18-inch turret
CVBB,
sitting next to the flight deck, and I could just imagine every time that fired, the entire flight deck would have been cleared.
Cleared.
Yeah. All the aircraft would have been straight into the ocean. But it's looking at that, and one of the interesting things I did in my PhD thesis on the Royal Navy in the 1920s and 30s, and how it coped with the economic crisis and how it built itself in that period. And you have some really interesting innovations come about. But at that period, you had officers like Admiral Henderson, who had the designers sitting in his office, and he was the control of the Navy. And he would walk into them and go, this is what I want designed. Take that design. Go to the shipyards and go, this is what I want built. And if they didn't build it, he'd whack them around the head and wouldn't pay for it.
Oh, that's so amazing.
And that was brilliant.
So great.
But the trouble today, we have very few navies don't have the technical departments to back them up. Very few of the admirals seem to have that amount of confidence that they will be backed up by the politicians in terms of if they do that. So they end up accepting whatever they're given. And that creates problems. And if you look at the UK, we basically have one arms manufacturer. They're called BAE. And whatever they want to build, they get to build and we buy. Because they're the only option. We try, but they are the only option.
Well, gentlemen, we have come up on our hour. So before we close out and throw out everyone's plugs, let's start with... Chris, final thoughts, observations, things that the listener perhaps should take away from him, they should take away with them that perhaps you have observed or thought were the most important part of this conversation.
Well, I think naturally the domestic issues in China and its impact potentially in the maritime space, but say the global economy, I find that quite an interesting topic to think about, but also discuss. It was a pleasure to hear Professor's opinion and Alex's on that issue. And then for sort of a novice when it comes to the maritime security and naval security scope, to listen about future capabilities and needs within, well, not only the United States Navy and what we'll be able to do in the future, sort of what ships to build, to the corvettes, to the subs, which I've heard about, which is quite interesting, in the technological advances in space, I think that is quite great to hear about. But otherwise, no, it was a pleasure to be here, and thank you for having me.
You know, Chris, let me ask you a question. I'd be interested in hearing this. You're pursuing a security studies degree. You're now trying to look at these military and security concerns. Where are you planning to go with that? Just with your commercial mariner background,
sure.
That's kind of an interesting. What is it? Where do you see yourself going with that?
I'm not pursuing a security degree here.
I
will return to the private sector, and I'm actually looking at either ship operating companies or on port development. So. My goal at the Fletcher School and listening to you guys and participating is to have a kind of a holistic interdisciplinary understanding of the maritime space. And I think I'd be remiss to not have a familiarity or knowledge about naval security. So that's really my goal at Fletcher, to have some background within that space so that I could interface in the future with say Navy or Coast Guard officials in the U.S., but then I will stay probably in the private sector. Also at Fletcher, of course, it's interdisciplinary, so it's not a security studies school, while largely policy focused. I think students range from international trade, which of course, as you mentioned, 90% of which moves by sea. So I think understanding the policies that impact that, whether it's which we didn't get to touch on, which I was fascinated by, which with Alex started off on, the food security issues and energy security. I've done a lot of work in agribusiness here and kind of trying to see future trends in the agribusiness sector and how that might impact shipping markets. But
we could come back. Actually, I'm glad you brought that up. The only one running the schedule around here is me, so we can definitely come back and Alex and Chris, if you guys are up for it, we can revisit that topic and talk about the food security issues as its effects on global trade.
Well, that would be a big thing to look at, and it's very interesting, some of the things, especially when you consider that Russia, China, India are all net importers of food. So, you know, while China owns American debt, they depend on American wheat.
And I think I've listened to this podcast before, and you've touched on, well, some of the problems the Jones Act carry. And I've always been interested, say, in the intersection of domestic issues and its impact on the international space. And say the Jones Act and its relationship with the Farm Bill as well, which requires the United States to basically transport United States grain or wheat, as Alex mentioned, and the food aid program to the international market in Bangladesh or where have you in East Africa. And largely that should probably be purchased closer to home, but the Jones Act carry and DOD and the maritime industry in the United States are, of course, doesn't want to lose that business. And sort of where do you find that balance? Do you want to promote maritime interests in the United States? Or, I mean, largely you could deliver that grain cheaper by purchasing from a local economy. So I find that actually quite an interesting debate.
All right. Filed. That is filed in the file there for a further follow-up podcast. Alex, final thoughts.
I said that, and I tell my students off when they say that. Every time they say when they're doing a presentation, I go, "That's not a word."
It's,
and I just did it myself. They're gonna be getting me back. The world is
okay,
complex.
I've been doing the entire podcast.
Thank you. The world, basically what I would like people to take away from this is that the world is a complex place and we need to look at it and discuss it. We cannot afford to let these debates take place just in sort of between just academics or people who are interested. We have to get a wider community involved. We have to get more people interested and involved and taking part in the debate. I remember in some of my studies in history are looking at the debates that were taking place in the 1800s, in the early 1900s and 1920s. You have huge public debates where people send letters to the press which are 2 pages long, and all these people are getting involved. And now today, it's usually just a couple of column inches in a paper at maximum, occasionally a radio argument. Very rarely do you hear much about it, especially when you compare it to the amount that seems to go over on about things like Big Brother or The X Factor,
or
which
Justin
I'm
Bieber.
Sure many people are interested in, but frankly, okay, I just like a minor readjustment in
just
that there'd be just
smidgen,
a little bit
yeah.
more. Just a smidgen.
A little less of Justin Bieber's drug habits and a little more of maritime security.
I have a lot of cousins. Justin Bieber frankly scares me. The amount of time I have to listen to that strange voice. And he released I know this is completely off topic, but he released an autobiography at what, 12?
Really?
Really?
No, man. Makes me just dislike him even more.
Yeah, that's just wrong. That would be a good reason for China to invade Canada.
we might all look the other way. Even the Canadians yes. are saying, you're invading to do what? Got it.
But
we'll turn our heads for the next 24 hours.
Yeah. The global security issues and getting back to this sort of maritime security, we have to think about what are going to be the issues, and we have to start looking ahead and thinking, what are we going to need to deal with them? One of the often things debated is the cost of ships. Well, yes, the cost is a problem, but you have to look at, what do I want that ship to do, and therefore that's what I'm going to have to pay for, and sort of start thinking more about a modulated approach to ships. Modular corvettes. I know earlier when brought up corvettes, we were saying they'd probably die in a conflict. Well, actually, if they're the task group's inner protection, and they're behind the picket ships, which would be destroyers, and they're there to provide the security, the inner security, and they've been armed with some modules, then they have a good chance of coming out intact, as good a chance as any ship within the task group, because they're part of that inner group. Sending them out on their own as pickets, that will get them killed. But using them as that sort of inner line of protection, and having your destroyers, your bigger ships, acting as your pickets, that makes sense. But you can only work if you run it that way. If you start trying to use the corvettes, like with the battlecruisers, if you start trying to use them as your frontline battleships, you are going to be cruising for a bruising, which is going to be very bad.
And Professor Smith.
Well, first,
last but not least,
yeah.
Please.
First, I vote for a podcast on food security, because I would love to listen in on that. That would be great. As far as takeaway points, I agree with Alex. A reemphasis on corvettes, modularity would be important. And the very idea that, particularly the idea that there needs to be a grander discussion. I mean, partly in the United States, this is partly the result of the Vietnam War, but with the Vietnam War, you see the academic community and the policy community head opposite directions. And we really haven't recovered from that. It's still both communities in many ways are operating within a vacuum. And the ability of these two communities to start talking to each other, sparking a more general discussion, I think is very important. It will lead to better strategic decision making. And to date, I just haven't seen on the part of our government good thinking. We are wasting resources. We are ignoring important emerging challenges. And eventually this has to stop.
Gentlemen, before we close out, of course, just as a reminder to everyone, we are speaking with the Phoenix Think Tank, the Pips of William and Mary, and the Neptune Group of the Fletcher School. Is there anything that you'd like to plug, Twitter accounts, websites, projects that you might be working on right now? Just let the floodgates open so that our listeners can go immediately to those websites and or publications and consume them.
Well, the PTT has a very good paper coming out soon by Dr. Tony Cummings on the naval aviation and the developments of that in the Second World War for British perspective. Another group I work with called British Naval History are always doing some excellent papers, and they're run by Sam McLean and I forget the other guy's name, which is going to probably get me hit around the head at some point. And, well, I'm AC_Naval History on Twitter, and I'm always enjoying conversations on there. I've joined it only before Christmas, and I've really found it. Before, I was a bit skeptical about joining it, but the amount of interesting conversations you can have, and you can really get more people involved in the conversation on Twitter. It's, you know, one of the interesting things I found there is where some of the random celebrities start to get involved. And you have comedians commenting on naval debates. And suddenly they seem rather well informed. And you're sort of going, but you're a comedian who makes fart jokes. Why do you know about this? Great that you do. Gets a lot more people involved. But seriously.
There is a weird dark corner of Twitter that's actually, I was hesitant too, and then I got into it, and I was like, whoa, hey, there's people actually saying real things. It's not just pictures of cats and the word lol.
The cats are sometimes strange.
That's true. And there's the Doge. People know about my problems with the Doge meme. I love that meme.
Speaking as a dog owner, the pictures of cats are strange.
Professor Smith?
The Project on International Peace and Security, PIPS, at William & Mary, we have a website. It's www.wm.edu/PIPS. You can see some of our previous work that we've done for some of our clients and just some of the projects that our students produce every year. We are very interested in interacting with members of the policy community on future projects, and all they need to do is drop me an email. My email's on the website, and we'll see what can be done.
Absolutely, and if you're listening to this podcast, you cannot go to the panel that we'll be having, I believe, on Friday.
That's right.
Because it's over, and this podcast is being aired on Monday. So, very sorry, but, hey, maybe we'll have another one, you can go to that. Chris.
Yeah, I think one of my predecessors, Caroline from Fletcher, she mentioned it beforehand, but the Institute for Global Maritime Studies, which is headed by a maritime historian at Fletcher School, and many of the Neptunes are members there, and while a small cohort here at school, we do like to approach the maritime space from an interdisciplinary lens, so naval security and maritime security is one component, but we do like to explore also the recreational and inspirational aspects of the sea, in addition to the environmental and commercial interests as well. So very interdisciplinary institute that helps fund graduate students such as myself. I was able to participate in a summer program up in the Arctic, which you've had, I think, of course, has come up quite often in previous podcasts. But I went to Svalbard for a week and participated in an Arctic shipping conference up there, which was fascinating. The institute is great. It's igms.org. And certainly check it out.
And for those who are interested in Arctic affairs as well, next week's podcast is going to be with A. Dennis Clift, the President Emeritus of the National Intelligence University and current Vice President of Operations for USNI, and it's going to be the first bi-monthly installment of his reflections on the Cold War, and it'll talk about his time in the Antarctic. So it's a little different, not the Arctic, it's the Antarctic. But it's rather interesting. He's a fascinating fellow, and I really recommend everybody listen in. So,
very cool.
Trust me, I am so pumped. Every other month, we're going to do a podcast with him for about 30 to 40 minutes, and he's just going to wax poetic about all the different things he did in the Cold War. I mean, his resume itself would be an entire podcast. So it's good stuff. You have been listening to Sea Control with Alexander Clark of the Phoenix Think Tank, Professor Dennis Smith of PIPS at William & Mary, and Chris Patterson. Oop, did I almost say Patterson? Sorry.
Peterson, it's okay. No
I'll
problem.
Cut that part out because I'm the editor too, so that works. Chris Peterson of the Neptune Group at the Fletcher School. We are produced by the Center for International Maritime Security. That is at SIMSEC, C-I-M-S-E-C, on Twitter. And www.simsec, spelled the same way, .com online. Please come look at the Next War blog. I am the editor of that, and it's a really awesome project.
Yeah.
And we are available on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio and apparently other places. I don't know how RSS feeds work or how they find this podcast. If you don't know about SimSec and you're listening to my podcast, that's awesome too. Please go online and whatever you're using, leave a comment. Give us 5 stars. We think this is a fine product, and we hope that you do too. Gentlemen, it has been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.